The only two things we can't fix is a broken heart and the crack of dawn. To talk to Mark, call 602-508-0960. That's 602-508-0960. Now, once again, here's Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock, my name's Mark Salem, and we're stuck with one another for the next couple of hours. However, if you have a car question or a car problem, now's really the time to grab a hold of your phone and give us a call, 602-508-0960. It's always early. It's easier to get in early than it is in the second hour, which usually fills up pretty doggone fast. But this portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Quality Transmission. Transmission overhauls are not the same, and not every car needs an overhaul. In fact, Bob at Quality Transmission says about one out of every four, one out of every five, and sometimes they go a month or two, one out of every seven, eight, or nine, or ten. So with electronic transmissions, Bob says that it's important to verify that the input is correct and the output is correct when you're looking at the computer. So if the computer sees a speed of 40 miles an hour, the computer looks at a chart and says, oh, I should be in third gear, and then it puts you in third gear. But if the computer doesn't ever see speed, then the computer may not shift you to second gear, and it may be something with the speedometer. So those are the kinds of things that really good transmission shops do. What they don't do is they don't end up doing struts and shocks and all kinds of other repair. They kind of stick with where they're really, really good, and that's why Quality Transmission in Tempe is one of my favorite shops. So if you need a transmission shop, he'll talk to you for free, and they'll drive your car for free, and they'll duplicate the problem for free. They'll do all that kind of stuff. They aren't going to diagnose your car specifically, or they're not going to repair it for free, but they'll do everything else. So, Quality Transmission there on McClintock, north of University in Tempe.
Caller Hector.
Before you start calling in, I'm going to admit that I ran out of gas last week on a motorcycle ride. Okay? I'm done. I ran out of gas. It's not my fault I ran out of gas. And those husbands that have been married as long as I have, you'll understand this. Now, the wives, but the reason I didn't stop for gas is because my wife didn't tell me to stop for gas. That's my excuse. That's all there is to it. When she tells me to do something, I do it. And she didn't tell me to do it. So I think we were about 8 miles east of Kingman on the I-40 when the old motorcycle coughed a couple of times and we hit the side of the road. I took a little bit of grief. That's okay. I'm a tough guy, but I want you to know it's not my fault. It's my wife's fault for not telling me to stop for gas in Seligman or Williams or wherever. All righty. Hector, good morning to you, buddy. How can I help you this morning?
How you doing, Mark?
Good, good.
Okay, I bought my wife a 2007 Honda Pilot, and I kid you not, a week after their warranty expired, I usually do all my work on my own cars, but I'm not really big on diagnostic.
Okay.
I'm more of a bullpen guy. The code came on for all the spark plugs, so I guess it was misfiring somewhere, but for every single one of them. I took it to a generic little AutoZone place, and when I was going to take it to, honestly, your shop to go get it checked out, the check engine light came off. So I had called, and they said not to come back, wait till it comes back on. About a month later, it came back again, but before, it was within 24 hours, it was gone, but the generic code said it was all the cylinders, or some, it was misfiring.
Cylinder contribution.
I don't know what that means.
No, what it's doing is it's as each cylinder fires, there's the little speed up of the engine, and the crankshaft sensor or the camshaft sensor tells it that. So you know that there's no way all the spark plugs went bad, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so go ahead.
Now, they said, I guess I was told by a mechanic friend of mine that it's something normal with the Honda Pilots to where the valves have to be manually adjusted. I just needed to know, is it something serious I should try to get done right away, or have it checked out, or do I just wait until the check engine light comes on again and haul my butt to a shop to get a diagnostic, a thorough diagnostic done?
Well, I think it's not knowing what it is, if we're... I don't know anything about this valve repair for an all cylinder contribution or an all cylinder misfire code. I'm not aware of that, and I've been wrong before, and I could be wrong now, but I'm not aware of that, and I frankly don't understand how a valve adjustment's going to fix a cylinder misfire across the board. A valve adjustment, if the valve is too tight or too loose, there are specific symptoms that include backfiring either through the intake manifold or through the exhaust, and you haven't said a word about that. And so I'm not sure that valve adjustment is what I'd do. I'd wait till the light came on, and then I'd take it in. But if you have all the cylinders and you've got a cylinder misfire on all of them, I would think that it would be the ignition module or the crankshaft sensor that's the intermittent. Because you're driving down the road and the computer is monitoring the RPM of the engine, then all of a sudden, poof, everything's gone. And then, poof, everything comes back. And the computer goes, oh, we had let me see here, we had 16 cylinders misfire, so divided by 4, divided by 6, or divided by 8. Okay, well, I'm going to put a misfire code on each one of those, but really, the computer just doesn't understand. Guessing is a bad deal on this. This is not where you, let's put spark plugs in it. Oh, that didn't do it. Let's do wires. That didn't do it. Let's adjust the valves. But in reality, I think what you're going to find is that someone's going to ask you to wait till it gets worse and easier to find. Because the fact that the light goes out means that it goes through drive cycles and it doesn't see that problem again. So the computers are self-erasing its memory. So this is a very, very intermittent problem. On the other hand, let me ask you this. If somebody said to you, hey, Hector, the crankshaft sensor and the diagnosis and the insulation is like $300, and according to all my research, that's really going to be the best guess. So here's your options, Hector. We can either do a $300 guess, and you have to understand we're guessing with your money, not mine. But I feel like that we're going to be in the 60 to 70% success rate. Or we can simply wait till it gets worse and easier to find. However, Hector, the real home run is when it quits running and doesn't restart ever. And then the diagnosis is cut in half because then it's easy to diagnose what failed. So you have three choices. You can wait till it gets worse. You can wait till it dies and doesn't start. Or we can make a guess. And my advice to you is just, let's just wait until it gets worse.
Okay. I will definitely listen to you because all your advice has always been on point.
Well, thank you very much for that. Thank you.
Oh, and by the way, tell your wife, because it's what I do with my wife, it's her beauty that distracts me when I'm driving, and that's why I forget things.
Her beauty distracts you. Well, I can't use that, Hector, because she has a helmet on. And her fingernails are dug into the side of me and her screams are so distracting. It's not a good thing. It's her fault though, Hector. I'm glad you agree because I'm gonna knock on the window. Hey, honey, it's Hector 1, Renee 0, or Mark 1, Renee 0. So thank you very much for that, Hector. I appreciate it.
Have a good one.
All right, same to you, buddy.
Bye.
All right. And Jeremy, who have we got next?
We got Derek.
Derek, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Hey, I've got a 2003 Kia Sedona minivan.
Okay.
And I was going to work, and one morning started kind of chugging and missing.
Okay.
And then finally about 10 miles in, completely died. I got it back home. I got no fuel. I've got fuel pressure, but zero spark. So I'm wondering where a good place to start is.
You know, that's a wonderful thing to hear something like that. I want to compliment you. You just told everything in a short period of time. You didn't guess, and this is easy. If you have fuel pressure, the reason why it's not running is because the injectors are cycled by the same electronics that the spark is cycled by. So if you have no spark, then you have no injector pulse, which means we have no spray. So you have diagnosed this as good as anybody I've seen in a long time. So the question now becomes, is it the crankshaft sensor that talks to the ignition module, or is it the ignition module that's bad, and it's only going to be those two, or in a 1 out of 10 chance, it's going to be the connection between the computer monitoring and the RPM. So if the computer sees no RPM, it sees no reason to cycle the injectors or to provide spark. In your particular case, if you wanted to guess, I'd guess with the cheapest component of the two, the ignition module or the crankshaft sensor. And I'd follow the directions exactly on the crankshaft sensor. Another thing you can do is get down there with a wooden hammer handle, find the crankshaft sensor, tap it a couple of times, have the wife crank it, tap it a couple of times, have the wife crank it, and then, or I'd put some cold water on it, and then I'd put some hot water on it, and if you can get that thing to start, Derek, then you and I have diagnosed the crankshaft sensor.
Nice.
That's all you got to do. But it's great that you knew that you had fuel pressure, because that answers the fuel delivery situation. And I know the electronics from the engine, the crankshaft sensor, is going to control both spark and injector pulse width. Not fuel flow or supply, but injector pulse width. What's the spray like? You understand it idle. It sounds like this. It goes...
2 minutes.
Then when your wife's driving and her foot's on the floor, it sounds like a fire hose. Okay? So that's the difference. All righty?
Okay. So I'm going to start with the... I'm going to start by trying the cam... Or the crank sensor, the cam sensor, sorry.
Yeah, I'm going to have you do the crank sensor, because I'd have to look it up to see if your Sedona has a cam sensor. Sometimes they have... only a crank sensor, and sometimes they have a crank and a cam sensor. The crank sensor tells it where number one is at, so the computer knows to count 1-843-6572. The cam sensor tells the computer where the cam shaft's at. So the computer needs to know where number one is, and then it needs to know how many cylinders there are, and that is all provided in the software. All righty,
okay,
Derek.
Great.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. It's not very often I get good symptoms like that. Makes me look like I know what I'm talking about. 602-508-0960. Jeremy says in my ear, they just don't know the truth. Is my wife in there with you, Jeremy?
Jeremy? No, she's not.
No, she's not? Okay. Are you just...
Can we just talking just me and you right now?
Yeah, just talking me and you. So she's not in there aggravating me?
No, I think you're clear right now.
Okay, all right.
Nobody would hear this if you were to say something.
Jeremy, do you remember last week when we were in the radio studio and we had the dogs?
I do, yes.
It is still a huge concern in my family about where the stench came from. And there was Alan, my son, me, and two dogs. And both me and Alan are pointing at the dogs, and the girls are saying that's craziness. But it really, you had to have been there to experience. So I'm quite sure that Alan and I are on the right track. Nevertheless, 602-508-0960. When we come back, we'll take your call. Welcome back, everybody. 21 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem, and I'm here for the next couple hours talking about car and car repair. Steve's on the line, and the lines are wide open, 602-508-0960. Let me tell you about Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing real quick. Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing in Mesa is the only Mesa shop on my list. I would never suggest that it's the only good shop in Mesa. I'm just telling you, it's the only shop that can pass the filtering system that I use before I let a shop be on the list of the best for our car repair shops. It just has to do with time in the seat and time in the saddle. It has to do with knowing right from wrong. It has to do with that more than anything else. Brian and Thelma have been in Mesa. Their family's been in Mesa since 1970. They have ASE-certified technicians. They work on domestic and foreign, the RVs and cars and trucks. And they're on Main Street just east of Stapley. So Main Street just east of Stapley on the south side of the road. If you don't have a repair shop, may I suggest that that's where you go. Jeremy, I want you to speak.
Yes,
to me.
Sir.
Do you have any idea how much a gas can costs from a service station that's a long way from help?
I thought you could just give them, like, your license and they'll let you borrow it. Now, that doesn't work anymore?
No. It's a little bitty gas can about the size of a Folgers coffee thing for $18.91, and after you get tax. And I'm telling you, I was floored, but I was grateful. I was grateful because we were traveling with Jim and Linda, and Jim and Linda went ahead and bought a can and brought us back some gas, not before taking lots of pictures of me. And many of them can't be published because I was doing nasty things with my fingers. And that ensures that they'll never see the light in Facebook. Did that make sense?
Yes, very smart.
But anyway, all right, well, let's go to Steve. Steve, thank you for holding. How can I help you today?
Yeah, I have a friend with a car he just bought. It's a 89 Toyota hatchback. I guess kind of a little stretch in the back. But he said the left front, I thought it was the right, but it was the left front tire wobbled loose when he got the tires replaced the other day.
Okay. And so after he had the tires replaced, then after he left the shop, one of them fell off or wobbled?
No, he just said there was a little wobble, so he just wondered what was up, you know.
Okay.
Control rods, U-joints, what it might be.
Okay. Okay, well, if it's an 89, it still could have strut suspension on the front. But the easiest thing to do is put a floor jack underneath the center of the car and unload that wheel. And get it off the ground. It doesn't have to be off the ground more than a couple inches. You know, just enough to get your fingers kind of near the bottom. I don't want you to put your fingers at 6 o'clock on the tire. I want you to put them at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock, so if the jack falls, then it doesn't smash your hand. But you're basically going to take the top of the tire and the bottom of the tire, and you're going to wiggle it. It could be wheel bearings. It could be lower ball joint. It could be the upper strut mount. So it's going to be one of those three. Now, it could also be the lower control arm bushings, because we have this Y-looking, or this triangle, that comes out to the lower ball joint. And the triangle, the wide part of the triangle, is up, and those are the bushings that allow that arm to go up and down. It's called a control arm. So the control arm has three components. It has bushings on two of the sides, and then it has a ball joint on the third side. So you're going to find it, and there's also going to be related tire wear. So if the ball joint's bad, then the inside of the old tires wore like crazy. If the bushings are bad, then it's probably the inside of the tire, inside edge of the tire wore like crazy. If it's a tie rod end, it could be any portion of the tire. And if it's the upper strut mount, that's probably going to wear the outside edge of the tire. So what the old tires look like would be kind of important if you're going to diagnose that kind of problem. But we start with just wiggling it, and then we just look to see where the play's at. And then you fix the play. If you want something to compare it to, the reason why I want you to jack it up in the middle is so you can do the other side as well. So in a comparison point of view, you could grab the passenger side tire, top and bottom, and shake it and feel just a little bit of a chook, chook, chook. But then you grab the driver's side, and you wiggle it, and it goes like 2 inches one way, 2 inches the other, and then you go, okay, bingo. And then you can look and see where the play is on the driver's side versus the passenger side, and make sure he uses jack stands when he's got the car up in the air. But that's how we diagnose it. And most shops would give you a quick look at the front end on that car. If they didn't do it for free, I doubt if the bill would be more than about $25. So
is there any danger to driving the vehicle in the meantime? Yeah.
That, I can't answer that, Steve, because I don't know what's wrong with it. If the ball joint itself has got a tremendous amount of play, then the answer is yes. If the ball joint can come loose, that tire's going to collapse on the ground, the car's going to turn really hard left, the driver won't have any control of it whatsoever, and it's going to destroy a bunch of the metal underneath the car. So, but on the other hand, if it's the bushings that are bad, then typically they don't go bad and cause that kind of a calamity. Typically, they get to where they knock so loud that the driver finally gives up and has them replaced. The upper bushing's the same way. It'll knock and make a lot of noise for a very long time, and if you ignore it until it actually comes apart, then you deserve whatever happens to it. So the lower ball joint's the one I'm, and the wheel bearing, those are the two I'm most worried about. Alrighty?
Okay, thanks, Spencer.
You betcha. Play in left front wheel. Got to write that down so I know what we're talking about. Jeremy, who's next?
We got John.
John, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Yeah, I've got a perplexing problem with headlights.
Okay.
I've got a 97 Super Station Wagon Legacy, and all I've got is passenger side high beam. Low beams are as dim as the parking light.
Okay. All right. Are the headlights square?
Well, they are, yeah.
Okay. And it's the same headlight, or do you have four headlights or two headlights?
Two.
Okay. All right. have you done any work on it, or do you have an idea what might be wrong, or is that your question?
Well, initially I had a high beam go out on the driver's side, so I changed the bulb and it didn't cure it. And then I had within a few days I had the low beams go dim like that.
Okay.
And Mark's house said, "Well, try changing the connectors on the back." So I got a connector loom kit.
No, that's not it.
I didn't think so, yeah. But anyway, so I tried it and it didn't do anything.
Okay. Well,
I slammed it. And then they went on for a while.
Okay, well, this is kind of easy because we have to perform a volt drop test, and that's something that all of us know how to do, and we can do it with our eyes closed. But basically, you're going to check the voltage in the ground to the headlights, and one of them is deficient, and it's probably going to be the ground. So in your particular case, the repair or the diagnosis would probably be less than $50. But you could also have a high beam dimmer switch that's bad. But the fact that the lights work but they're dim tells me the fuse is fine. And I'm up against a break, so I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to give this some more thought. But we know the fuses are fine because you do have high beam and low beam. It's the intensity that we're working on. And the intensity on the low beam typically has to do with the ground. And when we have a yellow low beam or a yellow high beam, it's because the bulb doesn't have the ground. Your big square lights have three connections on the back. One of them is power to the high beam, one of them is the power to the low beam, and the other one is the ground. You could take a little wire with an alligator clip and go to the negative side of the cable and touch the ground one, and if the lights went white and bright, then I'm right, then you have a ground problem. I wouldn't chase the ground problem, I'd just install a new ground, and that's all I would do. Just circumvent that and just install a new ground. We'll be back in just a few minutes, right after news, weather, and sports. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. My name's Mark Salem, and we're here helping you with your car questions and car problems. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. We got John on the line, but we're going to tell you about Larry Harker's Auto Repair. One of the biggest compliments one shop can pay the other is to hire the shop. And it's not uncommon for us to do that. It would be rather pretentious of me to tell you that I can fix every car ever made, because I can't. There's going to be guys that do a better job than I do in certain areas of the car. So if you need interior work, we don't do that. Larry Harker's Auto Repair is at 38th Avenue and Indian School, and lots of shops in a geographical area all around him send him their diagnostic work. And here's why. It's because their customers are best served by having the very best guy do it. So if you live anywhere near 38th Avenue and Indian School, Larry Harker's has been around. He's been around since 1967. So they do foreign, domestic, they do auto electrical, brake work, auto emissions, vehicle maintenance. They handle all areas of auto repair, both foreign and domestic vehicles. But when it comes to tracking down the bug that's really driving you crazy, Larry Harker's is the place to go. Again, that's 38th Avenue and Indian School. Great place since 1967. Okay, John, on your Subaru, I'm going to do this kind of slow, but I'm going to explain to you how I would test it. I would use a digital voltometer, and I would pull the plug, and I would turn the high beams on. And then I would determine which one of the three wires is the ground, and I would determine that by using my digital voltometer. So I would clip the negative to the battery negative, and I'd take the power, and as I went around the plug, I'm going to have one of them that's going to power up. That's going to be the low beam or the high beam, and the other one's going to power up, but the third one's not going to do anything. And I'm going to know that that's the ground. So then I'm going to go do a volt drop test, and I'm going to move my clip from the negative side of the cable, negative side of the battery cable, to that terminal. And from there, I'm going to check power to the other two terminals of the three that you've got on your headlights. And then I'm going to do what we really calls a volt drop test, and I'm going to see how much we're losing between the battery negative and the negative provided by the headlights, and I'm quite sure we're going to figure it out then. So am I going to go in and look for a bad connection on a ground strap on a 1989 or 1997 Subaru? No, I'm not. I'm just going to put a new one in. So I'm going to grab a hold of that ground wire at one headlight, which hopscotches to the other one or comes from the other one, and I'm just going to run a sheet metal screw into the fender, and I'm going to take my little scotch pad on my air grinder, and I'm going to grind a little bit of the paint off in a place that no one's going to see, and I'm just going to put a new ground in there. And then I'm going to make sure that the negative side of the battery goes to the engine block. There should be a ground from the negative side of the battery to the fender. There should be a ground from the fender to the firewall. There should be a ground from the firewall to the radiator support, because we have to have all that stuff grounded. So sometimes we hopscotch the grounds, and sometimes we just run a ground to each one of them. But I'm quite sure that your problem is you have a bad ground. Thank you very much, John. Let me tell you real quick about a guy writes me a note, and he says that he takes his car in, and it has a check engine light on it. And they do some work on his check engine light, and at the end of the day, it doesn't fix the problem. And then they tell him it needs $2,200 worth of valve job. And when we talk, he's asking me if that sounds reasonable. And folks, look at it from my point of view. I'm only getting his side of the story. So, and he only knows what he's been told by the shop. And so when I ask him questions like, which cylinder did they say the valve was a problem? Well, this is at number 3. Okay. Did they say what's the matter with it? Well, they said the valve was staying open. And I said, okay, do you have a backfire? And he goes, no. And I said, do you know what a backfire is? Yes, I do. So you don't have a backfire through the tailpipe or underneath the hood at all? No, pow, pow, pow when you're driving it and accelerate. No, I don't. Well, see, you can't have a valve that's open if it's staying open. And you can't possibly drive the motor without having it backfire, because as the explosion occurs, if the intake valve is open, then it's going to explode through the intake and into the air cleaner, and you're going to hear that. And if the exhaust valve is held open, then it's going to blow up, and that explosion is going to go into the exhaust system. Sometimes it'll blow your muffler clean off your car. So these are the kinds of things. And then the $2,200, he didn't know what that included. And I want you to get a detailed estimate. You're not asking the shop for anything that they don't already have. In order for them to give you an estimate, he has to look up the labor to remove and replace one or two heads. He has to look up the labor to replace two or three or four valves. He has to have a gasket kit, the oil, the filter, the coolant. He has to have the machine shop services. He has to have some number in there to resurface the heads. He has to have his number in there to wash the heads. And he may paint the heads to put them back on. So he already has all that number. So the question is, specifically, what does $2,200 cover? And the problem is that we have an intermittent miss that happens at idle that goes away above idle. And that intermittent miss, after they put spark plugs and a bunch of other stuff in it, didn't fix it. First of all, I wish I could get away with that. I had another guy send me an email, and he took a Jaguar into a repair shop, and he had a problem with the Jaguar, and he said that they did $1,800 worth of fuel pumps, and at the end of the day, he still had the problem, and they said, well, we need to do further diagnosis. I don't get away with that. Look at it from my point of view. You're going to bring your car to me, and I'm going to tell you, well, I need to put, you know, $400 worth of spark plugs and wires and this and that in it, and, you know, that's what the code says, and that's what I need to do. And you say, okay. You don't say okay. You say, is this a guess or a fix? So I'm going to do $300, $400, $500 worth of work, and then at the end, I got to call you back and say, well, in terms that of wasn't it.
The approachability.
The Mike Gallagher Show.
The problem with
Mark, you there?
Yeah. Right before Dennis Prager at 9.
We went out for a while. We were just dead air, so I went into the commercial break. The
okay. Do you remember where I was at?
Hi, I'm Dan Davis.
It literally just happened maybe like 30 seconds ago.
Okay.
A lot of people are hanging on to their cars to save money, but driving an older car.
Welcome back, everybody. 44 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. I'm sorry for that glitch. That was my fault. I didn't retrain our connection and appropriately, and so it dropped us. But the gist of what I was talking about was this. It's okay to ask the shop if this is a guess or a fix. If your suggested repair or your suggested money spending or your suggested amount, is that a fix or a guess? And then the next question is if it's a guess, whose money are we guessing with, yours or mine? That's okay to ask. I wish I could sell $1,800 worth of fuel pumps to someone and then feel like it's okay to call you back and say, that didn't do it. We need further diagnosis. Do you see that? Can you feel with me how objectionable that is? I mean, that is so self-serving. And the real issue is that when you talk to somebody who, and you have a drivability problem and they talk about spark plugs and fuel, then what that tells me is they haven't spent enough time on the car and they don't know whether the problem is in the spark or fuel delivery system. You see, folks, there's only three things we need to run your car: compression. And compression is either there or it's not. If it's not, the car's not going to run. So compression doesn't come and go. So we have compression, then we have spark and fuel, and then we have to have the appropriate timing. When your fuel system goes down, you die. Your car dies. And when your spark system goes down, your car doesn't start either. But when you have a drivability problem, we have to determine if it's fuel-related, fuel supply-related, fuel pressure-related, or if it's an electrical with respect to spark or the timing or the distributor or the cap or the rotor or the coils or the spark plug wires. All that stuff has to be analyzed. And we have the equipment necessary to diagnose that without guessing. That's my point. We don't. Now, there are times that we guess, and it sounds like this. Mrs. Jones, I can't get your car to act up, but I've worked on your car for about the last 20 years, and I can tell you your car has an inherent problem with a component called a pickup assembly, and that pickup assembly and the labor to install it runs about $100, $150. Now, Mrs. Jones, if I were to replace that, I would say that my odds are better than average, better than half, that I'm going to fix your intermittent Stein and Stalin problem. So, therefore, I want to tell you, I would suggest you entertain the idea of spending $141.50 to replace the pickup assembly. But I want you to know that I'm guessing with your money. I'm not guessing with my money, Mrs. Jones. I'm guessing with your money. The other option is wait till it gets worse and easier to find. But you only have two options: guess or wait. So there, I've given you both options, Mrs. Jones. Tell me what you decide you want to do, okay? That's kind of what it is. So that's what a guess sounds like. A guess doesn't sound like, I'm going to spend $1,800 of your money and replace both fuel pumps underneath your Jaguar seat, and then if that doesn't fix it, I'll call you back. Come on. Who does that? 47 minutes after the hour, let me tell you about Kurt's Auto Repair. Kurt's Auto Repair, if he guesses, he tells you. And you know, in relationship to the car count, that's maybe once a week. So your chances are 1 in about 100 that we're going to call you and say one of the options is to guess. And typically that's an intermittent problem, and it's one that we're well aware of and that we fixed many times before, and it may have one or two possibilities. So we're going to guess with the cheapest one first. So that's what it's all about. Kurtz Autos was the winner of the 2015 Better Business Bureau Ethics Award. I was at the dinner. I was proud that Kurt is one of my shops, and I'm proud to tell you that he works on gas and diesel. He's at I-17 and Bell Road, the northeast corner. Kurt's a good guy. His family's a good guy. His employees are good people. They know right from wrong, and you just couldn't find a better shop in the area of I-17 and Bell than Kurt's Auto Repair. Terry, good morning to you. How can I help you this morning, Terry?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a 1990 Chevrolet 4x4 with a 350 V8.
Okay.
And I'm a winter visitor, so I'm heading back to Wisconsin soon. Now, this old truck, I don't hardly drive it more than 900 miles a year anymore. But a few years back, it started puffing a little blue smoke when you start it up in the morning.
Yes.
So I took it to a shop, and they replaced all the valve seals in it.
Okay.
Well, then about a month after that happened, it just started smoking like crazy. It uses a quart of oil every 500 miles now. You drive it at a stoplight, sit there and idle, go to take off, it leaves a big puff of blue smoke.
Okay. I got
it
you.
It runs great. It doesn't miss, runs great, doesn't fall out of plug.
Well, not yet. You can't go through a quart every 500 miles and you're going to foul a plug sooner or later. You could find which cylinder it is by pulling one side and then the other, and you're going to see the spark plug that's consuming oil. this truck had O-ring valve seals on it.
Right, and I had cup O-ring seals put on it. So
those are called umbrellas. Is that what you put on there, umbrella seals?
Yeah,
okay.
Umbrella seals.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So the real question is where's the oil coming from? And that's what has to someone has to diagnose that. One side of the head, the returns are plugged, so the head is filling up with the valve cover is filling up with oil, which floods the seals, which also allows the PCV valve to suck oil out of the full valve cover, when all we really need to do is pop the valve cover off and clean out the return holes. So as oil is pumped into the valve cover, it can return to the bottom of the motor. If you have only one dirty spark plug, then you probably broke a ring, or you probably are, you know, drawing a whole lot of oil through that valve. The valve seals is a Band-Aid. And if the seal itself can't control the oil because there's so much wear between the valve stem and the valve guide, then no amount of seals is going to fix that. So my suggestion would be this. Let's first figure out where the oil's coming from. Let's figure out what cylinder's involved. Let's do a wet-dry compression test to see if we broke a ring. Let's see if we're pulling through the valves. Let's make sure that we are not filling up one side or the other of the valve cover with a whole bunch of oil. Let's do all of that, and everything I just mentioned is $125 or less. So the checking it out would be easy, and I'm talking about our industry as in general. I'm picking the middle because I usually say 75 to 125, but I think what I just described is probably in the middle of that. So that's the reason why I'm using 125, 100 to 125. So
now I got one other question with this truck. In between that time, it developed a leak in the back of the intake manifold, a water leak.
Okay.
So the intake manifold was pulled off and new seals were put on and put back on. Could that have caused any of that problem?
Well, yes, it can, because if the gasket isn't put back on right, it's going to suck the bottom from the bottom of the intake gasket is right there by the valley underneath the intake manifold, and there's oil there. So if you don't get those intake gaskets right, then it's going to. But here's the bad news and the good news at the same time. If it's an intake gasket, that's kind of an easy diagnosis because it's only going to be affected to one cylinder. Now I want to ask you a question. On this runner that the gasket has failed, we are going to create a vacuum on the rest of the engine, inside the rest of the engine. So if I were to take a cork and stick it in the PCV valve grommet, and I were to put a vacuum gauge on the dipstick tube, if the intake gasket is bad, I'm going to see a vacuum on the dipstick tube. Otherwise, it's like somebody connected a vacuum cleaner to the inside of the engine. I'm going to see a sucking going on. Well, if the intake gasket was just done, that means somebody made an honest mistake, because we've done that as well. So I'm not going to beat up the shop. But certainly it would be okay if you went back to the shop and said to them, shortly after you did the intake, I started consuming a tremendous amount of oil. Would you please double check to make sure that that gasket is still where it needs to be? That would be a nice way to ask.
So that possibly could be the problem and not the valve seals.
Absolutely. And especially if it's localized to one spark plug or a pair of spark plugs, because we can lose the gasket on the bottom of two intake runners, but they're going to be Siamese cylinders. So it's going to be two cylinders side by side. So it's going to be one and three, three or five and five and seven, or two and four, four and six and six and eight. It's going to be two cylinders or one cylinder. But we first have to pull the spark plugs to find out which cylinder is drinking all that oil. And then that's where your investigation starts.
It would basically be quite an easy fix just to replace it. If that was a problem, just to pull the intake off and reseal the intake and put new gaskets on.
It's not on a 1 to 10 scale, on difficulty, that's really only a 5 or a 6.
Yeah.
It's probably hard the first time.
Easier than pulling the heads and doing a valve job on it.
I don't blame them for doing valve seals. I think the valve seals is successful and slows the rate of oil consumption 99 times out of 100. I'm not saying that was a bad decision. I'm saying we need to eliminate the intake gasket before we go to step two and we need to diagnose what's drinking the oil. And then once we know what's drinking the oil, we'll know whose fault it is, if it's anybody's fault. So, all righty?
All right. Thank you very much, Mark. Right. It's been a big help.
Good luck to you. Thank you very much, Terry. Hey, Tom, good morning to you. How can I help you this morning?
Good morning. I have a Lexus RX 300, the original 1999. We're winter residents. We're leaving Wednesday. How do you prepare the car to be garaged for 8 months?
I got your answer, buddy. You're going to take it out and take the wife shopping or head up to Anthem or, you know, go to Wickenburg. I want you to put some miles on it, maybe 15 okay. one way, 15 back. I want you to pull into a quick lube facility, and I want you to have them change the oil and air up all the tires to the maximum inflation written on the side of the tire.
Okay.
Check all your fluids, but I want to store the car with fresh oil and filter. Then from there, I want you to drive it to the gas station, and I want you to fill it all the way up with gas. I don't want you to stuff the tank, just one click, two clicks, that's all.
Right.
Then I want you to take it and put it in your garage, roll up the windows really, really tight. If you want to disconnect the battery, fine. You don't have to disconnect the battery. Roll up the windows good and tight. Hide the keys inside the house really well, so if they break into your house, they can't steal the car. And right. it will store like that for 6 to 8 months with no problems whatsoever. But I want fresh oil and fresh gas in it.
What about the tires?
The tires at 35 pounds. I want them at 35 pounds because the door sticker is going to give you an inflation for a couple of butts in the car, not as fully loaded. And I don't want the tires squatting for 5 or 6 months. I want the tires sitting up tall. And I don't want any flat spots on the tires. We don't typically have flat spots on tires nowadays because nylon tires had flat spots, and we don't have nylon in that same arena that we used to have in the 60s and 70s. But I'm still feeling better. Well, I'll put it to you just straight. That's what I do on my show cars. That's what I do on my hot rods. I inflate the tires to the maximum inflation. It stresses the tire less. And then if there's a slow leak, I'm not going to sit on the flat tire for all that time. I'm going to have a little extra air pressure. And then when you come back, if you want, go from 35, which is the maximum on the tire, and you can drop down to 32 or 28, whatever the sticker says, and that's okay too.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Thank you very much. When we come back, we're going to take more calls, and you're welcome to join us. It's 57 minutes after the hour. I'm going to take a break here at 58:50, call it 59, and then we're going to be back at about 4 minutes after the top of the hour. So we're about 5, 6, 7 minutes away from the second half of the show. The lines are wide open, and Jeremy's asleep. So if you call right now, 602-508-0960, Jeremy will take your name. And then at that point, you can set the phone down and just kind of keep an eye on the clock. And at about 4 minutes after the 11 o'clock, then just come back to the phone. And as soon as we get done with what we need to do, then we'll take your call. So that number again is 602-508-0960. I want to tell you, too, when we come back, if we have time, about a Suzuki that was purchased from a used car lot and ended up with a bad motor and how that turned out. It actually turned out pretty good for the lady who bought the Suzuki. And there was some twists and turns that created a really unusual situation, but I'll share that with you. And I think under the best of conditions, you might learn something from it. And it really has to do with just making sure that the contract says what it says. We'll be back right after this.
With the real car guy, master technician, Mark Salem, where the only two things we can't fix is a broken heart and the crack of dawn. To talk to Mark, call 602-508-0960. That's 602-508-0960. Now, once again, here's Mark.
Welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name's Mark Salem, and we're talking about car repair problems and tires and all that kind of stuff. So if you'd like to join us, you can, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Quality Transmission in Tempe. Calling around to get prices on a transmission repair is typically a bad idea because nobody really knows what the repair is. So everybody's numbers are going to be different. The process involves let's get it diagnosed first. Let's get a detailed estimate, and then you can call around and say something like, to replace the solenoid pack in my Chevrolet, and to service the transmission with fluid and a filter, and what would that cost? And what code would that create? And what's your diagnostic process and what's the fee associated with that? With that information, you can then make an intelligent decision on what to do. Quality Transmission will talk to you. They'll drive your car for free. They'll talk to you for free. They'll look at your car's computer for free. But sometimes there is some diagnostic processes that involve some disassembly, some pin checking, some voltage checking, some ground checking, and that stuff won't be free at Quality, but it isn't free anywhere else either. So if you want to talk to somebody and if you want somebody just to drive your car and comment on what you think is wrong with it, then Quality Transmission is your place. They've been in the Valley since 1977. They're in Tempe. They're on McClintock, just north of University and just south of the 202. Quality Transmission. Alrighty. So a lady buys a Suzuki from a used car dealer, and in a short period of time, the block has a huge crack in it, which necessitates a completely new engine. Initially, the car was thought to be under a manufacturer warranty, and Suzuki raised their hand and said, you know what, we can replace this motor for free under warranty because it still has a powertrain warranty on it. However, that deal fell through, and it wasn't Suzuki's fault at all. What had happened was is this car initially was a rental car, and when it's registered as a fleet, it doesn't have the 100,000-mile warranty on the motor. It has a 60,000-mile warranty. That's all part of the program. So this $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 motor just went out the window. So they go back to the used car lot and ask if they can just give them the car back and unwind the deal. And of course the used car lot says no. And so then they hire an attorney, and the attorney gets involved and finds out that there's laws that talk about implied warranties and the absence of this document versus the absence of that document. So I'm happy to tell you that what has happened is the attorneys for both the person who bought the vehicle and the attorney for the repair or the used car lot have come to an agreement, and they are going to give the lady back her money. Now, they're going to be left with a motor that's bad, but everybody agrees that the lady had nothing to do with the crack on the Suzuki V6. It's just the nature of the beast. It's the first time I've ever seen an engine crack like this, but it's all over the internet, and Suzuki's well aware that this happens. So somebody's going to have to put a motor in the car, and the next person that gets the car is going to get a new motor, and that's kind of good too. So maybe the used car lot will be able to put the motor in it and still make a profit on it, and if not, whatever. But it's a good story, and it had a happy ending, and I think everybody's still talking to one another, and I think the attorneys behaved themselves. I think everybody in the process behaved themselves, and I was happy to be a part of it. So those things do happen in my world. Good. For every good story, I can tell you five that turned really ugly. but I'll spare you that. I do want to tell you about tire expiration. Tire expiration and tire aging is an idea that's been around for 25 years, and that is when should a tire be taken out of service and thrown away? And this has been going on for 25 years. What hasn't helped any is companies like Goodyear and all the rest of them, they use words like, we think you guys ought to tell your customers that they should get rid of their tires somewhere between 6 years. And another company says, no, 7. Somebody else says, well, between 6 and 8. And someone else says, between 8 and 10. The fact of the matter is that they don't know what the 10 commandments are because they don't write like that. I want a 11th commandment that says, thou shalt tell the customer the tire must be removed from service when the tire hits X years old. Here's the problem. Without a mandate from the manufacturer of the tires, when our industry tells a customer that, then we're accused of using scare tactics. And obviously, we don't want to be accused of that. So our industry is in tremendous flux and has been for years. But here's what's happening right now. There's lots and lots of lawsuits. I think I'm actively involved in 3, 4, 5 of them that has the question, should the shop have told the customer how old his tire was? Here's the issue. I have instituted a new policy that follows Discount Tire's policy. And Discount Tire says on their website, and I agree with them, that we're not going to touch your tire, we're not going to air your tire, we physically aren't going to put our fingers on your tire unless we're taking it off to replace it. we're not going to be involved in touching that tire, because if that tire at 10 years old blows out, everybody's going to be in the food chain. So I have a case right now where some tires were installed. One of them blew out. Four people died. And the tire was 12 years old. And everybody who touched that tire in the last 4 or 5 years of its life is now being named in the lawsuit. So we have to deal with that in some way. The answer is for the tire manufacturers to put an expiration date on the tires. However, there's a problem with that. And here's the problem. The problem is they would be glad to do that. But they can't agree whether it ought to be 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10 years. They can't agree on that. Number two, it would virtually double their tire sales overnight. And a lot of people find that kind of objectionable. And I think if you pick 6 years, that's what you're saying to us. I also think that each manufacturer can tell us when their tires should be taken out of service based on the quality and the preparation and the manufacturing of that tire. But they're not willing to do that. On the other side of the coin are the lawyers. And the lawyers don't want an expiration date on the tires, or most lawyers don't want an expiration date on the tires, because that would eliminate many of their legal cases, many of their plaintiffs' cases, many of the lawsuits. So that's what's going on. But our industry has asked NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the federal government, those idiots east of the Mississippi River, along the Virginia River up there, we asked them to make the decision, and we gave them all the facts. And they just recently said to the industry, the tire manufacturers, the repair industry, the tire sales retailers, nah, we don't want to do that. So we're in flux again. So as a customer of mine, I want to tell you that we're going to keep track of your tires, and we're going to tell you how old they are, and we're going to tell you what your options are, and we're going to tell you what we think you should do. But we're not going to do it in a scare tactic format. It's going to sound like this. Your tires are 6 years old. We just want to put you on notice that they're 6 years old. Because here's the problem. You got people in Sun City and in Ahwatukee and East Mesa that drive 2,000 miles a year. So they got Hondas and Civics and Corollas and Chevrolets and Fords and Dodges that are 10 years old that have, 8,000 miles on them. So that's really hard to tell this senior citizen that those 10-year-old tires are dangerous, especially when all they do is drive to the store and back, and rarely do they go to California loaded up with a whole bunch of beer to go to the ocean or to the river. So those are all the dynamics that go on. I'm going to tell you from a point of view, of a safety point of view, you should monitor the wear and the condition of your tires after they turn 6 years old. And I think that under no circumstances should you travel at all over 45, 50 miles an hour with a 10-year-old tire. I think you're putting yourself and your life, your family into danger, and all the people around you into danger. So that's what I know. I'm a tire maintenance expert. I testify in court about tire maintenance, reading of, the wear patterns and what people should do and what shouldn't they do and what do they do wrong and what do they do right and all that kind of stuff. I am not a tire manufacturer expert or a tire composition expert or an expert that can talk about how the tire is built. I'm not that. But I am an expert in the field of maintenance. And right now, in my opinion, I think our industry has a responsibility to let people know how old their tires are and to warn them that their tires are getting into an area which is 6 to 10 years, that virtually everybody agrees the tire should be aged out, or in other words, the tire should expire, or in other words, the tire should be taken out of service. I think that we should drill holes in the tread of the tire so that they never get back on the road again. And as far as some of the Goodyear RV tires that have caused so many deaths, when we take a G159 off of a motorhome, we drill 2-inch holes in the sidewall so that tire will never see the light of day again, because we don't want anyone to die. And we still see motorhomes that come in with a Goodyear G159. That's the model number written on the side. If you have a Goodyear G159 on your motorhome, here's my promise to you. I'll sell you tires at my cost. I'll show you the invoice just to get those tires off the road.
2 minutes.
They're dangerous. They kill people. And what you're not told is that tire was never, ever rated past 65 miles an hour, and it failed some stupid number like 98% of the time at 65 and higher. And they didn't tell us that, and that tire has been in hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits. But just the other day, I had a guy call me and ask me if he could bring his motor home. And of course, I said yes. And when he got there, he had G159s on. And I said to him, here's the information. I'm going to send you links, and you go on the internet and read these links, and I'll bid six tires for you. And he ended up putting six tires on. I think the bill was $3,000 or $4,000. And I said to him, I'm going to cost them out to you because I need to get these off the road. It's not I need to, it's we need to. So your family's not safe, and you can't take my grandkids in your motorhome if you have a G159 tire on them. I don't even want to be within the same zip code as you if you have those tires on. But that's just a tire aging issue, and that just happened to be a really bad tire. So that's the issue. The issue is when do we expire your tires? Our industry basically will agree that it's somewhere between 6 and 10 years. No one is past 10 years, and no one is earlier than 6 years. But we can't even agree on whether it's 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10. As far as I'm concerned, 10 years, I'm not touching your tires. I'm only going to take them off if you instruct me. But as far as rotating the tires, airing up the tires, or even doing an alignment, I'm not doing that on a 10-year-old tire. And that's just my small way of keeping you safe, whether you like it or not. 602-508-0960. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. 21 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem, and the phone number to call in on is 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. Let me tell you about Action Auto Repair. He's up at I-17 and Deer Valley Road, northwest corner of I-17 and Deer Valley. And what's special about Action Auto? Well, it's special because he's been in business since 1983. It's special because Tom is a great guy. He knows right from wrong. He knows how to fix cars. He's very analytical, and he's a great diagnostician. Him and his staff, they can provide you all kinds of service, maintenance, diagnosis. They have ASE Master Certified Technicians. They're going to get the job done right, and they want to help you as car owners understand what they're doing and why, so they want you involved. They take you into the shop. They show you the bad parts. They show you the symptoms. They show you that kind of stuff. And that's why Action Auto is a great place. I-17 in Deer Valley, northwest corner. Real quick, one of the other things that just wads up my underwear in a way that you can't imagine is that many of the car manufacturers and tire manufacturers, Goodyear, Michelin, Bridgestone, Toyo, the car manufacturers, every single one of them, they talk about that you should have your tire. And this is the way for them to eliminate any responsibility of them. So they say, you, as the car owner, should have your tires inspected annually by a certified tire professional. Here's the problem with that. There is no such thing as a certified tire professional. Is the tire professional the three-whiskered kid that works at the tire store 2 days a week and hasn't graduated high school? And his job is to mount and balance tires? Or is it a guy like me who's been around tires for 40 years and can tell you what size it is without looking at the sidewall? Is a tire professional, well, who are they? What kind of experience do they have? What do they look for? Are they looking for weather checking? Do they know what weather checking is too much or too little? Do they know what alignment issues look like? Do they know what underinflation and overinflation looks like? Do they know what a tread separation looks like? All that kind of stuff. But nobody will stand up and say, this is the definition of a tire professional. A tire professional. Here's why. It's because anybody who raises their hand and says, here's the definition, everybody will argue. And this will go on just like it does in every other world that's controlled by men. It'll go on for 100 years. So when they talk about have your tires inspected by a tire professional, I'd look for somebody with gray hair. I'd look for somebody with an ASE certification on tires. And I would probably look at somebody who's been around a tire shop for most of their life. That's a tire professional, in my opinion. Harry, good morning to you. How can I help you this morning?
Good morning, Mark. Hey, have you ever thought maybe about carrying a little gallon can of gas in your saddlebag or something in case your wife doesn't alert you to the fact you should?
Who put you up to that, Harry?
If I'd run out of gas like that, I think I'd be thinking about it.
Oh, God. You know, we just bought it's new to us. We bought a trike, and it's a Honda Goldwing. And my wife had every orifice in that trike completely filled with, you know, her stuff, because we're going to spend we went to bike week at Lake Havasu. So anyway, I knew that when I got to reserve, and this is a fuel injected motor, and I knew I had an electric pump in there, and so I kind of sloshed the gas around, and I knew we were approaching Kingman. And I was within 8 miles of where I was at, but it was her fault. I don't care what she says; she denies it. But she tells me when I can eat, when I go to sleep, when I wake up. She tells me what to do every minute of my life. So it has to be her fault for not saying, you think we ought to stop and get gas.
Well, you got an easy life. You don't have to concentrate on hardly anything.
You know, the only thing she can't tell me how to do is fix cars, but she can sure check and guess and laugh at me when I don't. So, no, but you're right. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to carry a small can of propane, and I'm going to run a line and plug the line into the intake, because the propane's going to be easier to manage. It's going to be safer. It's not going to spill and contaminate all her wonderful clothes. With that can of propane, I think I can make that Goldwing run for 10, 20 miles. And as long as I meter the amount of propane into the motor, and I think that's going to be better and safer and easier for me. Plus, it's a much smaller container than something, you know, of a gallon size. But I'm actually going to assign her the responsibility in writing and have her sign off on it that there's one gauge on the dashboard that belongs to her, and it's the gas gauge. So I think that's going to work. But you know, I don't know. If she hires a lawyer, then they'll have to negotiate.
Hey, I got a question on tires.
Okay.
You're saying the date code 10 years. Is that what you're...
Yes.
Saying?
We all know that the tire probably didn't hit the road for a year, because it takes about a year for the tire to come off the factory, go into the what we call the warehouse distribution center. Then from there, it goes to another distribution center. From there, it goes to finally another, and then finally it comes to me. So we're cognizant of the fact that the age of the tire is probably... but. You know, Harry, half the experts say, oh, it's the sunlight, and a tire ages on the shelf. A tire ages on the shelf in San Diego and in Phoenix and in Detroit and in Winona, Minnesota. And even if you're in Alaska, a tire is going to age on the shelf. And it can just be bad right on the shelf, Harry. I mean, really.
Well, you're losing 10% right there.
Yeah, that tire, after 8 years, can be bad. It can be brand new and bad on the shelf. Have you ever seen one of those, Harry?
I've got a motorcycle tire out my shop that's 25 years old. It's still wrapped.
Exactly.
I don't know if it's good.
Exactly. And so all this kind of discussion goes on, but you're exactly right. There is a lag. The other day I called and I said to my tire vendor, I've got a guy who's really into the tire expiration issue, the tire aging issue, so I want some poppin' fresh tires. And he laughed and he goes, I'm scared to ask what you're asking me. And I said, I want you to look at the day code and give me four of the newest ones you got. And the best he could do was about 11 months. So he gave me four tires that were all had pretty much the same day code, but they were 11 months old.
Minutes.
That's, you know, and I put them on the car, and he was happy with that.
That's what I ran into with utility trailer 12-inch tire, and what they gave me was 13 months old. And I said, don't you have anything newer, you know?
Yeah.
And now about trailer tires and, you know, tires that kind of sit outside or whatever, you're still saying 10 years on those?
Well, here's the thing about trailer tires. A trailer tire that starts with ST before the size, means standard trailer tire, that has a speed limit of 65 miles an hour, and it blows apart at 66. So I've never seen an old trailer tire, because every young kid with a hot rod Ford diesel truck coming up the mountain to Payson to go to Roosevelt Lake or go to Saguaro Lakes doing 70 and 80. And every Saturday and Sunday you see those guys off to the side of the road with their arms up against the trailer wondering, what the heck am I going to do, because I just blew this trailer tire and wiped out the fender and everything else.
Minute.
So The answer is trailer tires don't last that long, so I'm not real worried about them. But if you want to, go to an LT, a light truck tire on your trailer. Now you can do 75, and they'll carry the load when they're appropriately sized. They'll still carry the load, but you get the increased speed rating.
So they have the sidewalls stiff enough to handle the...
Yes.
You know,
yeah, it's just a matter of load. You got a single axle trailer, and you've got a 4,000-pound axle. I need 2,000 pounds of tires on either side, and you can find a passenger car or light truck tire that's got a 2,800 limit. So now you got 5,000 pounds of tires holding up a trailer that only was supposed to weigh 4,000 pounds, and that's perfect as far as I'm concerned. I'd rather have more tires than I have weight. And so that's perfect.
So,
Harry, I got to run, buddy. Thank you very much for calling in. And anybody else, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. My name's Mark Salem. This is KKNT 960 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. It's, let's see what time it is, 34 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name's Mark Salem. Every Saturday between 10 and noon, we're here talking about your car questions, your car problems. And let me tell you real quick about Automatic Transmission Exchange. We affectionately call it ATE. Automatic Transmission Exchange is a transmission shop that's been serviced in the Phoenix area since 1968. I promise you, Phil has gray hair. Phil and his staff are the transmission diagnostics experts. Phil does everything really, really well. But if you've got a sand buggy or if you've got a hot rod and you need a hot rod transmission that might hold back 500, 600, 750 horsepower, Phil's the guy you need to talk to. Phil can build anything. He understands and has the capability to build you a custom transmission that'll hold up to just about any wear and tear you want to put it through. So Phil is, and as a matter of fact, if you drive down to 40th and Washington, you'll look at his place and you'll say, I've driven by this 100 times and didn't even know they had been here since 1968. Phil's a good guy. Automatic Transmission Exchange, serving the Central Phoenix area, actually the whole valley, and he's located at 40th Street in Washington. Well, good morning, Ken. How can I help you this morning?
Good morning, Mark. I totally agree with you on tires, and I also live in Payson, and I see those warriors on the side of the road all the time.
You know, I actually stop every once in a while, especially, and I'm in Payson right now, as a matter of fact, where I'm transmitting out of the ranch. I've been at the car show all day long. If you've been there. Well, if you're there, I was taking pictures this morning from 8 o'clock until I had to leave at 9:30. One of the things I'll do is if you're coming up and down Payson and you have a tire that's flat and your spare is flat, then just stand there with your chin cupped in your arm with sitting on your flat tire, and guys like me will stop and air your tire up for you.
I love it.
But it is true. Those of us that travel up and down the mountain, we see it all the time.
It's a theme. Here's my question.
Okay.
All right. I've got a 2004 Chevrolet Silverado 2500 series. I purchased it brand new in 2004. I've had lots of different trouble with it. General Motors has these problems that they don't address. But anyhow, those are not what I wanted to ask you about. I have a problem going on right now where, put the key in the ignition. It doesn't happen all the time. This is something that's periodic. In other words, you could drive the truck for two and a half months, everything's fine.
Okay.
One morning you come out, you put the key in the ignition, you turn the key, and nothing happens.
Okay.
Nothing.
I got you. I want you to do this. Do you park it in the garage or up against the garage door?
I park it facing the garage, yeah.
Okay, good. I want you to go to MarkSalem.com and copy FAQ 28.
Okay, hang on a second. MarkSalem.com.
FAQ 28. Now, let me tell you what FAQ 28 says. I want you to turn on, when you hit the key and nothing happens, I want you to turn on the headlights. And I want to know if they're there, or if they're white and bright, or yellow and dim. Okay? Now, I want you to leave the headlights on, and I want you to hit the key again. And I want to know what the headlights do. Do they go out completely and come on ever so slowly? Or do they go out completely and come on as soon as you let go of the key? Or where do they start? Where do they end? Are they yellow? Are they white and bright? Because that FAQ will diagnose what's wrong with your truck if you just pay attention to the headlights, which we're using as a voltmeter.
Okay.
So let me give you an example. When you hit the key nothing happens, and you hit the key and the headlights don't dim and they're white and bright, that tells me the neutral safety switch or the solenoid is bad. And in your case, it's probably the solenoid, and you would do the starter and the solenoid as a package. If I'm right and the solenoid's bad, then you hit the key and nothing happens, and you don't have your business suit on, so you crawl underneath the truck with a little hammer, and you just tap the side of the solenoid two or three times. You get back in the truck, and it starts. Then you've just diagnosed the solenoid being bad. So at that point, you'd replace it. Now, if you hit the key and it dims a little, and when you let go, it comes back on, that means the solenoid is activated, but it's not activating the starter. If you hit the key and the headlights go out completely, and then the minute you let go, they come back on white and bright, that also tells you that the starter's bad, because the starter drew a whole bunch of amps, but it's not spinning the motor over. So you can diagnose the solenoid, the starter, a bad battery connection, and a bad battery with FAQ 28. And that's all you need to do is pay attention to the headlights. So, if you'll do that and call me back and let me know how you're doing, or if you have some results that you're unclear about, you can email me at mark@marksalem.com. Mark with a K at marksalem, like the cigarette, .com. S-A-L-E-M. That's for anybody. Anybody can email me if you have a car question and you're too shy to be on the radio, then email me your car question and I'll help you out. Work really hard on giving me the year, make, and model and the mileage and the symptoms. What's the problem and what are the symptoms? And that helps me out a lot. When we come back, George, you're going to be my first caller, so stay right there. We'll be back in about 2.5-3 minutes. My name's Mark Salem. It's 11:39 and we're 7 seconds away from 11:40, and Jeremy wants me out at 2:01 now. Welcome back, everybody. It's 44 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock, and we're just wrapping up the show, but we got open lines available. George, you're going to be next, but I'm going to talk about IMM real quick. IMM Auto Service is a friend of mine. David owns IMM. He's a friend of mine. He's a good friend of mine, and you know why? It's because he likes to fix cars that I really can't do a very good job on. I don't know what it's like to replace a starter or a clutch on a Saab, a Fiat, an Alfa Romeo. Those are, and Volvos. Those cars are an animal all of their own. You know, a cow and a horse and a cow and a cat and a dog, they have four legs and they got a tail, and okay, they're all the same. Let's throw a snake into the mix, or let's throw some eagle into the mix that flies. That's what these cars are like. They don't follow mainstream anything, but IMM works on specifically Swedish, Italian, and Asian vehicles. So Volvos, Saabs, Fiats, Alfa Romeos, those are the cars. Now, you may not want to take your car there for an oil change, or maybe so you do. But when you have a problem, you are best served at IMM in Tempe. David and his crew are really, really good. They have ASE Master Techs, and they do a good job. That's IMM Auto Service in Tempe. George, good morning to you. How can I help you this morning?
Well, I'm afraid I got something to cause you to punch the windshield.
Okay.
Got a new piece of paper from MVD there in Bash's Shopping Center on Tuesday. It's recreational motor vehicles, ATC and ATV.
Uh-huh.
Since the vehicle was not manufactured for use on public streets, roads, and highways, the owner must submit a properly completed highway use certificate form 96-0371 to certify that the vehicle meets all applicable safety and equipment requirements for on-road use. Any off-road recreational, and they left out the word vehicle, that is used on the road must be properly equipped for highway use. The ATC or ATV may be registered when the vehicle, and amongst a whole bunch of requirements here, it says if 90 cc's or more requires emissions. Are we going to have to get quads smogged now?
they don't have any infrastructure up here to do that. So the Maricopa and Pinal County is that's written for Maricopa or Pinal County, but everybody knows in the Payson there is no smog. That's why a lot of people that live in the valley, of course, register their vehicles up here so they don't have the aggravation. But let me tell you, this isn't as bad as you think. We just bought a four-seater Polaris. From the Rye dealership, as a matter of fact. And we put a windshield in it. It has a horn. It has headlights. You can use your arm for turn signals. And we put some street tires on it because our intention is to use it just locally around our house here. So it wasn't that hard to get streetable. It's really a matter of, you know, if you don't want to put a windshield on your quad, then you have to have a face shield or a helmet or glasses. So there, the police are going to cite you for something that you don't have that you should have. And that you're, it's not mandatory that you have turn signals, so you can use your arms like we used to do in the 50s. I've asked law enforcement up in Payson if they're going to cite for non-DOT tires, for off-road tires on the highway, and they said no. They said they don't see a problem with that. Most of the quads are not going to do 70, 80 miles an hour. I think most quads, realistically, are in the 30 to 45 mile an hour range, with some of the higher speed ones that can do 60 or 70. But really, who's going to be zipping through Payson at 60 or 70 on a quad? I mean, you're only going to do it once before you go to jail. But in Maricopa, you have to take your quad in to have an inspector at a motor vehicle department inspect it before you can get a street license plate. I think up here there's an affidavit you fill out where you tell them, I have eye protection, I have headlights, I'm going to use turn signals and that kind of stuff. So I'm not a legal beagle on that, but no omissions, no omissions.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, it's a creeping infringement on freedoms is all.
Well, I appreciate your honesty, and I can tell you that there's a lot of people that would agree with you, but I want to tell you what my version of emissions is, okay? I want to give you your car, George, and I'm going to put a big wing nut on the dashboard, and I'm going to back that wing nut out about 8 turns. And I'm going to say to you, George, let's get going 60 miles an hour on a flat stretch of ground, 60, 65, 70, whatever you want, George. And that wing nut there is attached to the fuel delivery service on your car. So we're going to start screwing that wing nut in a quarter turn at a time. And you know, George, that sooner or later we're going to hit the spot where one quarter more, we drop from 70 miles an hour to 68, right?
Right.
Okay, that's vehicle emissions. Vehicle emission says, let's trim the fuel down to where we get to lean drop. So let's screw the screws in. Let's adjust it to where we just lose 50 RPMs, and then let's give them back the 50 RPMs and hold there. That's truly what vehicle emissions is all about. It's shut off the abundance of fuel that's coming out of your tailpipe that's polluting the air and that's not doing any good on your car, on your motor, or for the air we breathe. And that's truly what emissions is. It's just, if we could have that screw, that big wing nut looking item. Do you remember the old cars, George, where you could advance the timing with the little lever on the steering wheel?
I hate to admit it, but I do. I had one.
Now, do you remember, you used to drive down the highway, and you'd advance the timing, and then pretty soon the engine would start knocking, and you'd lose a little bit of power, and you'd back the timing up, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly what vehicle emissions is. That's exactly what vehicle emissions is. Just shut off the fuel that's not doing you any good. It's kind of like a stream that drives over a water wheel. Let's say that the water wheel's 10 feet wide and the stream is 10 feet wide. As the water goes over the water wheel, every drop of water drives the water wheel. But what about if the stream was 50 feet wide and the water wheel was only 10 feet wide? Then we had a whole bunch of water going over the cliff that didn't drive the wheel. That's what vehicle emissions is all about. I'm a cowboy. I am not a tree hugger.
If I can offer something here, what I see is that the average automobile on the road, the engines are 15 times the size of the 300 cc's of my quad.
Yeah, you're right.
Just what is producing more smog. It looks to me, again, like the Sierra Club has done a good job of lobbying the state legislature to get the quads out of what they call their forest.
Okay. I agree that there are clubs out there that don't want us in their forest. I agree with you there. I don't agree that they're using plates and license plates to get to take the quads off the road. They're in this whole equation much earlier, and I'll tell you why. I'll bet you dollars to donuts if your quad's less than 10 years old, it has a catalytic converter in the exhaust. So the catalytic converter is going to burn up any additional fuel the motor doesn't use. That is an emissions control device. You bought it with you had the car. They're involved in, let's make them clean before they get into the forest, because there's not much you can do to a quad nowadays to make it really puke terrible emissions. There's no screws to turn on a fuel-injected quad. There's nothing someone can do to make it really pollute the air, because the computer controls so much of the emissions and so much of the fuel delivery. So I'm afraid, like you are, that, and I think you'll agree with me on this, if we would just stop being stupid in the forest, if we would stop doing circles on our quads, those younger people, stop doing circles and tearing up the vegetation, if we'd stick to the roads, if we would enjoy ourselves, but there's no reason to spin your tires, there's no reason to tear up the vegetation, if we just behave ourselves, I think we'll still have the roads. But I think there's a small minority of people in the forest that make it tough for the rest of us. And I'm not above and beyond, and probably I would suspect, George, you're the same way. Sometimes you pull into an area where they're just tearing up the vegetation, and I'll get out of the quad and I'll just stand there with my hands on my hips, and I think the message to them is that I don't like what they're doing. And so many times they know that, and maybe they'll move on.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Anyway.
Right. Thank you very much, George. All righty. 602-508-0960. Vehicle emissions is something that I've been involved in since vehicle emissions first started in the 70s. I am really very good at vehicle emissions, understanding all the different systems and stuff like that. I'll give you another example of a system that's in every one of your cars and you don't even know it. We have a system where we're going to suck the fumes off your tank and burn them with your engine. And that saves you fuel economy. And it also prevents the fumes from escaping into the atmosphere as a hydrocarbon and contaminating the air that we breathe. So the computer will sense that the fumes need to be vacuumed off the tank. So it closes one valve, opens another, brings those fumes, sucks those fumes out of the tank, runs them through a charcoal canister, and then runs them back into the engine. It's an additional source of fuel that you otherwise would not have used.
Caller Billy.
So there's all kinds of stuff. Positive crankcase ventilation valves. It's a $3 valve, and it does wonderful things for clean air. Oxygen sensors do wonderful things for clean air. MAF sensors, MAF, mass airflow sensors. All that stuff is just to just use exactly the amount of fuel we need to make the car do what we need it to do and not a drop more. All righty, Billy, good morning to you. What can I do for you?
I got a 2000 Ford Expedition 5.4 engine. The wife said that last week she turned the air conditioning on and she smelled something. So I'd done some checking. First, I thought it was antifreeze, but I'm sure it's oil. On the, the intake manifold?
Uh-huh.
In the gully there, it was oil.
Okay.
I cleaned it out, and I've been watching. There's no more oil. So what's going on?
Oof. You know, I don't know the answer to that. Let me tell you this much. When you're on normal air on your Expedition, we're sucking air from the vents by the windshield wipers. So that's where fresh air is coming in, and then we're going to run it through the cool or the warm heater core or the evaporator for the air conditioning, and then we're going to blow it into the van, into the Expedition for you. When you smell something from the engine, then if you go from normal to recirculatory, we shut those vents off, and now you're just going to recirculate the air inside, so we're not going to contaminate it. When people have older engines that leak a little oil and the fumes related to this, the burning oil bother them, then we simply tell them to go to recirculatory, and that will shut off the suction of the air from the hood area. As far as your oil leak is concerned, next time you go in for an oil change, do you usually go to a quick lube shop or do you go to a regular repair shop?
Well, last time Ford did it.
Okay.
Then you go to a quick lube.
Okay. I think I would go to somebody who does engine work, and I would just say, can I pop the hood, and I point right there. There was a big puddle of oil right there, and I cleaned it up, and it didn't come back. What do you think that is? I think that's a reasonable request, and it might cost you an extra $4 for your oil change to actually have a master tech to talk to, but I think it's worth it.
Let me ask you another quick question.
Okay.
I noticed on that intake manifold, there's two lines. One's a quarter-inch line and bolts straight to the center of the engine, and there's another about a half-inch line, plastic line. They're both plastic. Is this, one of them lines got to do with oil?
No, not at all. That's going to be vacuum or coolant. So if you touch them and they're hot, then they're coolant, and if you touch them and everything else is hot and they're not, then they're vacuum. But those won't have. We don't have any exterior oil lines on your Expedition except for power steering. That's the only one we got. All right, George or Billy. Thank you very much, Billy. Thank you very much for calling, and good luck to you. For the rest of you, I just want you to consider that it is in your best interest anytime you get an estimate to ask for a detailed estimate. Exactly what does the estimate contain? Because the shop, in order to give you an estimate, had to fill in all those blanks. The problem is that one shop will bid a timing belt, 17 other parts plus the labor, and one shop will build just the timing belt and the labor. And you need to know that the difference in price has to do with the difference in a whole lot of components that are going to be replaced. So it's good that you know that so you can make an intelligent decision. But don't be afraid. Get your pen and pencil and say to them, okay, give me the first thing and give me the price. Give me the second thing and give me the price. Ask for a detailed estimate. It is in your best interest. Plus, it's easier to shop a detailed estimate than just some valve job for $2,200. No one can shop that. And they tell you it's a valve job for $2,200 because they know you can't shop it. So that's what works well. Mark at MarkSalem.com.